It's summertime, summertime, some, summertime, 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 some, summertime, 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 some, summertime, 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 some, summertime, summertime. We'll shut them books and throw away, say goodbye.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurik, Jack Spencer, and Samantha Shriver. And also joining us in MERS World headquarters today is our friend Andrea Bitely and our old friend Josh Pugh. A new Josh Pugh, though, because you're not with AFL-CIO. It made me very sad to see you switch, Josh, but I know it's probably going to be all for the better in the long term.
That's exactly right. Transitions are always bittersweet. Really excited to be starting a new adventure here in mid-August.
You got a new haircut, too. Did you get a new haircut?
Well, you know, it's all about new beginnings here on the MERS podcast, isn't that right, Kyle?
All right. Well, thanks, Josh. A little later, the Department of Health and Human Services Director Elizabeth Hertel will be joining us. And also the State Board of Education member Tom McMillan going to be talking about what we're going to be doing with schools and his thoughts on vaccinations and masks. You can maybe able to guess where he is on that. But first, some news over the weekend that a Michigan Republican Party has decided that they're going to do an early endorsement convention to get their nominees ready for Attorney General and Secretary of State. This is something that the Democratic Party started in 2010. They did again in 2012. And then this past cycle for governor and attorney general for 2018, they did as well. Theoretically, it gives these nominees a little bit of a head start, but I wanted to start with you, Andrea, on that. And smart move, or are we just following the Democrats?
I think those don't have to be mutually exclusive. I think it's both smart and learning from what others are doing successfully. Our nominees last go around only had a few months compared to Democrats who had more than a few months. So I think this is a good move on their part, the Republican Party.
So, Josh, where did this come from? The Democrats started this in 2010. I think this was a Mark Brewer creation, wasn't it?
I don't recall, but I do. I will tell you, like Andrea said, in this new age of elections starting earlier and earlier, especially with absentee ballots, even before 2020, it came coming into greater and greater use. You just have to get out there and start fundraising, and you can't do that if you don't have a nominee.
You know, John, the other option is here is that they may be wanting to do this early endorsement convention just in case the person that the party nominates is someone they don't really like. And so if the person like falls flat on their face before the actual convention where they officially nominate, they could always pull back the endorsement if they dip their toe in the water and they say, you know, I don't know if we want to do this.
They certainly could, but I mean, I think the truth of the matter is that, look, these races for Attorney General and Secretary of State are huge races now. There are many statewide gubernatorial races and the millions of dollars could spend on these things. And I think it just makes sense to ramp, you know, give it a longer runway, let them sort of stretch their wings as the candidate, especially in this case when you've got an incumbent. The Republicans need time to take her on and state their case.
All right, Jack. So on a different note, the Republican Party did not take up any type of censure resolution on Ed McBroom or Congressman Upton or Congressman Meyer. Why do these things keep coming up?
They did not take up a censure?
No, they did not, which is different than the Macomb County Republican Party, which last week decided they would like to censure Senator Ed McBroom, who does not live in Macomb County. Of course, he lives up in the Upper Peninsula. But they still felt it necessary. Why are these parties doing this?
Well, the Macomb County one and so on, they don't really have to worry about, you know, who else you get up there. They're obviously a great deal of more distance between them and the UP, whereas the state party, you know, is for the whole state. All those people know is that they believe this stuff, or a lot of them at least have to hold the position or pretend like they believe that Trump really won the election. So they're going to express that at their local party level. But let's face it, Ed McBroom violated a, shall we call it, a red Kool-Aid norm. You're not necessarily supposed to believe this stuff, but you're not supposed to let on to the fact that you don't believe it. That always is going to ruffle a lot of feathers within the party.
If you're Ed McBroom, Andrea, how concerned are you that the Macomb County Republican Party has just censured you?
I'm really more concerned about getting the cows milked in the morning than I am about what Macomb County Republicans say about me at this point, if I'm Ed McBroom.
But doesn't that represent a feeling, though, within the Republican Party? I mean, there may be folks in the Upper Peninsula who are like-minded as the leadership in the Macomb Party. Yeah, this could spell, or this could be a precursor that there are folks in his district who feel the same. And he could be a one-termer for basically putting out a report that said that there was no discernible proof that there was widespread election fraud in the 2020 election, which is not what the grassroots want to hear.
If McBroom is smart, all he has to do is remind his UP constituents, hey, these are the Macomb cats that wanted to defund our roads. Remember them?
They wanted to take money away from us so that they could fund their roads.
Yeah, these are the same people that are censuring me. We really want to listen to them. That's what I'd say if I were Ed McBroom.
Can't disagree with that. And also, until the First District GOP says anything to Ed McBroom, I don't see anyone caring about the Macomb County GOP, as far as Ed McBroom is concerned.
I think to Jack's point, there is a little bit of posturing going on here, too. And as he eloquently stated, it's not necessarily that you actually believe these things, because if they really did believe that you can't trust the outcomes of these elections, two things would be happening. One, there might be a little bit more outcry based on the results of those Senate primaries that happened a couple weeks back, especially since those results did change over the course of the night as absentee ballots came in. And the second thing that would be happening is they wouldn't be deciding their candidate for governor at the polls next August. And so if you can't trust the elections and you can't trust these local clerks all the way on up to the Secretary of State, show me the money, Republicans. Why are you allowing these local clerks to determine your nominees for state Senate and for governor?
I always thought that was a problem with the logic here. And Samantha, maybe you'd have some thoughts on this here. I mean, here you are, you're saying that the election is fixed. We don't know exactly how it was, but it was. And yet we are going to rely on the elections going forward to change the leadership. How can you count on the very system that you're bashing to get relief for the problems that you're bringing up?
What I am specifically thinking about is a conversation that we had, I believe what it was at like 2 weeks ago during the August 3rd special primary, where you had two candidates running in the two different special Senate elections who were running off of election integrity, Patriot approved, I need a forensic audit platforms. You know, we had Terrence Mikowski over in the Macomb County area, where he actually received the Macomb County GOP endorsement for his campaign. And then you had Kevin Green, who promoted himself over in the Grand Rapids area as I am the only person running who's demanding a forensic audit. At the end of the day, we went through those Republican primaries and I had brought up the question, are we going to see these grassroots forensic audit MAGA movement voters really show up and infiltrate these special elections to put their candidates into these Senate seats? Or are we going to see what we were already expecting? You know, and essentially, let's be honest, Kevin Green didn't win. Terrence Mikowski was the third runner up in Macomb County. I mean, they didn't bring in the numbers that we were kind of curious to see. So, I mean, you can censor people all that you want, but if you can't get those people to the polls to cast for election integrity candidates, all it really is a bunch of smoke and mirrors to keep animating your movement.
All right. And now the other subject I wanted to bring up here is James Craig, the Republican candidate for governor, has announced this week a bipartisan law enforcement action team where he is taking up public safety issues. He wants to put together a type of legislative agenda. And in doing so, he's brought in a couple Democrats, the sheriff from Macomb County, Anthony Wickersham, and the Gladwin County sheriff, Mike Shea. Those are part of a team that also include the Speaker of the House, Jason Wentworth, the former Speaker, Tom Leonard, and Mike Bouchard, among other Republican notables. Jack, as you heard about this, what did you think?
I think you ought to stay on your strength, first and foremost. Obviously, this is his strength. We also know that the governor's been doing some things on law enforcement here. So do you jump in and make sure you're getting your voice in there as well, on particularly the area that is sort of your specialty? The other thought I had is, how big is this in terms of an issue? I think it is a big issue right now, and it's going to be a big issue in the next election. It's probably smart to get off the ground as quickly as you can on this, because there's a reason the sheriff's races are a lot of times the most popular person in a county or a district is a sheriff. So obviously, it'd be kind of foolish to ignore it.
So, Josh, this is from the press release. Washington politicians encouraged rioting in our cities. Maxine Waters calls for increased confrontation. Do the Democrats have a problem on this issue?
Well, I don't know what James Craig thinks he's running for, but I'm not sure what Maxine Waters has to do with anything. I think the greatest threat to the lives and safety of first responders, and including police officers, is the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think that James Craig is someone who had COVID, knows that firsthand, and you saw him coming out and saying that he was vaccinated at the very first opportunity he had. You know, Benny Napoleon passed away from this. This is something that has threatened the safety of frontline workers at all levels, and police officers have been no exception. So I would love to hear more from all Republican candidates for governor, but especially James Craig, about what they would do to deal with this deadly pandemic that's still raging through this country.
Are we talking about the wrong issue then, Andrea? Maybe we should be talking about COVID-19.
I don't disagree with Josh there. The COVID-19 pandemic has, just over the weekend, you heard about a young cop in, I think, Florida who died from COVID-19. And we've heard from paramedics and firefighters, especially paramedics, about what they are facing every single day when they go to work. And we have numbers in the state of vaccinations that are not where they need to be. And I agree with Josh. I want to hear what James Craig and every candidate running for a statewide office is going to do about COVID.
But John, you got to play to your strength to start with. And James Craig doesn't have a lot of experience on COVID-19. He does have a lot of experience, though, in law enforcement.
He does. I still think, though, that the sort of the Republican push against defund the police, while it still has a little bit of grit to the sandpaper, it was much more of a 2020 issue that I think come this time next year is not going to be as salient, just because time has passed. The Biden administration has kind of moved away, made clear they're not for defunding the police. Most leading Democrats have kind of done the same thing. I think the issue set's going to be different. So I think he's kind of right now playing to a 2020 issue.
All right. We're going to move on to the next portion of our podcast with the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, Elizabeth Hertel. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Your first time. Aren't you excited?
I'm so excited. Thank you.
All right. That's what I want to hear. Okay. First question out of the box here. What is the state's role going to be in trying to address COVID-19 going forward?
The state will continue to respond to the pandemic by, you know, offering the best, most accurate information we can to the people of Michigan on how to mitigate transition and lessen their risk of contracting COVID-19. Obviously, right now, that lies in one of the three effective vaccines that we have out there that we have tried to make available across the state for individuals, make it as accessible as possible for people to get vaccinated, and continue to put out timely information as it comes out.
So basically, the state's going to be a go-between between the CDC and the locals, who are really going to crack the whip on making sure people are vaccinated and wearing masks.
Well, you know, we in the state of Michigan work very closely with our local health departments, as well as the CDC. The public health system, the way that we have it set up, has worked this way for quite some time, and we're really a team in making sure that we are getting information to people and answering questions as quickly and as accurately as possible.
Director, I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about sort of the state of this pandemic, because it seems like pandemics have different stages, and we're clearly in one that's much different than we were a year ago. Have we gotten to the point where state and even local mandates just simply don't have any purchase with the public anymore, that our only tool is education and individual compliance?
You know, I think we need to watch this virus very, very closely. And that's a determination that needs to be made as the virus continues to spread across the state. And of course, we're seeing different types of variants, which can really affect the way that we're responding. So right now, we know what is effective in fighting the Delta variant and the other variants of COVID-19 that we have seen in the state of Michigan and in this country. And those remain more basic public health measures of masking and social distancing, ensuring, you know, appropriate hygiene and hand washing. And then, of course, this vaccine is our best tool right now in fighting this pandemic. But as we've seen over the last year and a half or so, things have changed sometimes very rapidly with this virus, and we continue to watch it very closely.
So you're not ruling out future restrictions if this gets too out of hand?
I don't think we can ever rule anything out, especially when it comes to a virus that seems to be mutating rather quickly, and those variants, those different variants that it is mutating into seem to be spreading rather aggressively. So I don't want to rule anything out when it comes to, you know, pandemic response. But right now, we certainly know what our best tools are and how to use them.
I know that a lot of numbers regarding 2020 and the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic are still a bit premature, as there still is a collection process. But obviously, during the pandemic, we saw an increase in domestic violence. We saw an increase in mental health issues and concerns. And we saw an increase of opioid abuse and individuals driving under the influence of drugs and or alcohol. So let's say we get to the point where this virus has mutated itself to the point where more isolation could become an animated concern in the same way it was at the beginning of COVID-19. Looking at those numbers, how much weight do those numbers have when it comes to deciding if now is the time to go into another society pause?
That's a really good question. And I think it's really important to note, and you did note, that one of the things that the COVID-19 pandemic and some of the what we went through over the last year and a half or so has really shined a light on some of the behavioral health and substance use disorder issues that are present not only in the state of Michigan, but across the country. And you know, anxiety and depression being some of the major factors there, as well as isolation, which can, as you know, really exacerbate some of those underlying conditions. And I think it's really, really important that we continue to focus on and build out our infrastructure to provide services for people when they are experiencing a behavioral health issue. And we at the department and at the state level, over the last, throughout this response, have been able to offer additional services for citizens to be able to call and receive assistance, peer counseling when they are experiencing these services. But it absolutely should and will remain a focus for us while we continue to respond to the pandemic and even after in the years to come, as some of the experiences that people had, they'll have to, you know, work through and cope with those, you know, in the coming years. So it will remain a major focus for us at the state.
Yeah, I want to know, because I think it's still very confusing. People that are vaccinated, how much are they actually at risk for this Delta hitting them? My understanding of the article that we had in MERS was that even if they get it, it probably won't be very serious. And how do you get the message out there? How do you deal with the fact that you have half or more than half the population that are vaccinated, and you have the other portion that isn't vaccinated? And how do you make a clear statement about, okay, how should you think about this if you're somebody who's gone through the whole shutdown and been vaccinated? How do you deal with it? Should you wear a mask? Should you not? How do you communicate that?
It's a challenge to try to continue to communicate everything that we're learning as these new variants are being identified. The issue with the Delta variant that is still being studied is the ability for an individual who has been vaccinated, and the vaccines, all three vaccines, have still shown to be very effective in preventing serious illness or hospitalization when it comes to the Delta variant. The concern is the ability of an individual who is vaccinated to then transmit the virus. And so for that reason, at this point, knowing that we have a large segment of the population who has not been vaccinated or who cannot be vaccinated, primarily children under the age of 12 or those who have severe immunocompromised conditions, that we, you know, take the extra precaution of masking to try to prevent further spread to those who have not been able to be vaccinated yet. And that is, that communication can be a challenge. But we are working to make sure that, you know, we provide the information on where and how to get vaccinated for individuals, and making sure that, you know, people understand we do recommend taking these precautions to try to mitigate further transmission of the virus.
Director, I wanted to ask you about this directive that the governor put out on Friday concerning the speeding up of getting out the third dose, the third vaccine. When should they be getting it? Is there kind of a statewide plan or message that you're giving folks as to what they should be doing in terms of getting this booster shot?
People should speak to their physicians about whether or not it's appropriate for them to be getting this third dose. Those who have, again, immunocompromised conditions are at maybe at higher risk or contracting COVID, even with the two doses, if the initial two doses did not create a significant enough immunoresponse. And so what we're asking people to do is speak to their doctors and allowing that decision to be made between them and their physician.
I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about the rate of cases now versus a year ago. Is that at all a concern to you?
Yes, it is a concern to me. Whenever we see case increases, I find it concerning for a number of reasons. You know, one, it's always concerning to see people getting ill with a virus that we know can be avoided. We have precautions that we can take to prevent that transmission. But secondly, and what's more concerning for me, is that every time the virus is transmitted from one person to another, it has an opportunity to mutate into a different variant. And obviously, we've seen that a couple different ones coming through the state. And every time it mutates, it appears to become maybe more aggressive, either more aggressive in its ability to transmit from one person to another. And so in order to slow that transmission and slow the ability of the virus itself to mutate into different variants, we really, really need to make sure that we're slowing that transmission and stopping that transmission. And I think that's what's very concerning for me.
I know that I've talked to some health professionals that are essentially anticipating a fall surge. You know, it's time to go back, time to move back onto campus, time to put your kids back into school. Let's get the vaccine. And I'm looking right here. So the Michigan Senate Fiscal Agency, they had their latest estimation released on July 29th, which said that the state could reach 70% for those 18 and up to get full and to get at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine by November 13th. Would reaching 70% on November 13th be a future you would be content with?
I'd like to get higher than 70%, obviously, in the state. But the more people we get vaccinated, the more people that we have who are safe and taking those precautions against COVID-19. And so we'll continue to work to make that vaccine available to answer people's questions or concerns when it comes to getting the vaccine. And that's where we will spend a lot of our time and our focus here going into the fall.
How many people in Michigan get the flu shot annually? Do you know what, is there a percentage, is it even close to 70% to get the flu shot?
Traditionally, it is not, has not been that close to 70%. Last year, it was a little bit higher than what we had seen before, but you know, we work every year to make sure that people are getting the flu shot as well. And this year, I think it would be really effective if people are just getting both at the same time, if they haven't had their COVID vaccine yet, and make sure that they go in and get their flu shot so that we can prevent the transmission of both of these illnesses.
Has there been any thought to how effective lockdowns are as opposed to just social distancing and masks? And I'll bring that up because I've had people send me articles claiming, using Sweden as the example, the one country, it's approximately the same population as Michigan, that did not lock down. They just did social distancing and masks, and they had fewer COVID deaths than Michigan, although they probably didn't have as many obese people as Michigan had to begin with. But has there been any comparison or any thought that maybe the lockdown part may not be that effective, but it's the social distancing and the masks is sort of where the action is?
You know, I think we'll see a lot of analysis in the coming years. I hope that we will see a lot of analysis in the coming years on how effective some of our mitigation strategies have been. I think in Michigan, when we did have to go through some of those more stringent epidemic orders and gatherings limitations and those sorts of things, that it did serve to slow transmission of the virus, no question. But it'll be interesting to see those comparisons between states and other countries in the coming years.
One last question I want to ask you, Director. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey is a big proponent of natural immunity, basically meaning that you had COVID and now you can't get it again. What's your response to those folks who say, hey, look, I've already had COVID and that's just as good as getting a shot?
Yeah, unfortunately at this point, the science behind natural immunity is not as far ahead as the science behind the immunity from vaccines. That's not to say that there may not be some level of natural immunity once people have actually had COVID, but how effective and for how long that immunity lasts is still questionable. So from where I sit as Director of the Department of Health and Human Services, it's my duty to make sure that we are giving accurate information to the public. And the information that we have at this point that is the most accurate is about vaccines. That's not to say that in the future there may not be data that supports, you know, natural immunity, but at this point it doesn't exist enough for me to say comfortably to people that they are safe if they've had COVID. And, you know, I can understand why people have questions. I can understand if you've had an illness previously that you have immunity to and why people think that. But this is a new virus and we're still learning about it. And so it's my responsibility to make sure that we are giving people, again, accurate information that is backed by data. And I think it's a little concerning when we have different messages coming from different branches of government and confusing potentially people on what is the most accurate. And I would hope that most people would, or all people would, take the advice from the experts that we have in the Department of Health and Human Services, the people who've spent their careers studying these sorts of things and making educated recommendations, as opposed to other people who may just have an idea or have read a couple of articles.
The Director of Health and Human Services for the State of Michigan, Elizabeth Hertel, thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
Thank you.
Joining me on the other end of the line is Board of Education member Tom McMillan, former state representative. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks, Kyle. Joy being here.
All right. So tell me why you have taken such an interest here in local schools and what they're going to be doing about COVID-19, be it masks or vaccines, and really what the Board of Education's role is in helping see that through.
Well, I mean, I think the state board has a leadership role. We certainly don't have the authority, and I'm glad for that. I'm a real local control person, so we don't have the authority to decide mandates, yay or nay, at the local level. But I do think that we can give guidance, and quite frankly, there's a ton of parents that want to hear the opposing voice. You know, I mean, the governor and the, you know, the health department and even local boards have a big megaphone, and parents often don't feel that way at all, and they're shunned a lot of times. So I just wanted to provide that that voice of pushback, and really the voice that's really looking out for the kids and what's best for them.
It sounds like your other Board of Education members felt a little ambushed by your motions that you brought to the table for that last Board of Education meeting, and then just the numerous public comments surrounding it.
Well, I didn't know there were calls and people participating in person and phone calls from the public. I mean, it's a passionate issue. I mean, I brought it up, you know, like I had said, I wasn't for sure that I was going to do it. I probably was, but I don't know. I mean, we had plenty of time. We had many hours for them, and they worked up an alternative. So there was obviously not, and they voted to put it on the agenda. They could have said no, they don't want it on the agenda, but they put it on, and they agreed with me.
It's just so our listeners know, you had a couple resolutions, right? One mandating that, or one saying that school districts should not require vaccinations and school districts should not require masks, correct?
Right, that they, yeah, we would hope, you know, it wasn't authoritative, but it was saying that we should, they should, we would urge them not to require masks, and also not to penalize those who don't want to vaccinate. Not, you know, so that a lot of them are saying that if you're not vaccinated, if they're a sports team, that the kids that aren't have to quarantine and the kids that are get to play and things like that. So we didn't want to penalize those who don't vaccinate. That was the gist of that second proposal.
And neither one went through. You didn't feel like either one was actually going to get through, did you?
Well, I mean, you know, there was certainly one of the Democrats was kind of interested in one of the, you know, one of them. I don't know. I mean, when you put something on and you got debate and discussion, you never know where it's going to go, quite frankly.
Well, that's a good point. When I was talking with our reporter, Jacob Kanzler, about the motions and just the state board in general, we got into a discussion, kind of this is a broader discussion that we've talked about for some time, but the Board of Education itself and the amount of power that it does or really doesn't have. I mean, you guys can't do much as far as anything authoritative over the school districts. Does that need to be changed?
No, I mean, I'm a local control, but I mean, we do control, you know, we hire and fire the state superintendent, we deal with standards and approve them, and I mean, you know, we bring focus and spotlight if there's like, you know, there's some special ed issues that I'd like to bring before the board as well. And, you know, they're a very large department. So, you know, I wouldn't mind if we had this kind of a setup for almost all the departments at the state where there's some, you know, group that's kind of overseeing the director or the head of it that are elected. But not to digress. I mean, no, we have some authority. But no, I don't. I would prefer most of the authority to be at the local level as much as we can. That's kind of my goal, is to push it out of the state and down to the local level anyway.
But doesn't it hurt your ability, though, to be effective in not having the authority to basically tell school districts, no, you got to have a mask mandate, or no, you can't mandate a mask, or you can't mandate vaccines? It would be more powerful, though. You would have a bigger voice in, I guess, the discussion if you had that authority, though.
Yeah, but then, you know, at the state level, you can make a lot more mistakes with a kind of a cookie cutter approach. So I guess I would prefer as many decisions as possible at the local level, quite frankly.
So what did you make of all the public comment that you got on your resolution? You had like 100 folks who wanted to talk and it didn't have the opportunity because things got shut down because it had already gone 3 hours. What do you make of this response?
Well, it's obviously a very passionate issue. I mean, we're talking about, and you know, particularly, you know, mothers were a lot of them calling in, and you know, when you mess with their kids and really harm their children, parents and you know, mothers in particular on Tuesday, really, they get upset. They get passionate. You know, don't start telling my, you know, masking my kids when they don't need to, and you know, harming them, and not just their education, but many believe that their health is being put in jeopardy, and all unnecessarily, because these kids, everybody knows, these kids are at almost no risk of anything negative. Even the CDC has said that.
You use the term child abuse to describe the pushing of masks on kids. Isn't that a little over the top?
No, I mean, parents thanked me for saying that. And actually, I think it was a professor at Johns Hopkins just this week in the Wall Street Journal, him and somebody and from Tufts University, again, an epidemiologist or something, they use the same language. I mean, look, parents who feel they weigh the risks and they say, yeah, my child needs a mask, that's fine. But when we're talking about kids that don't need them, the parents don't want them, kids don't want them, and they're going to mask them and harm them for no reason. Yeah, you harm kids for no reason. Yes, that's child abuse.
So
I think the governor is complicit. I think the medical director. I mean, these are all people that are engaged in this.
But putting a mask on a kid, why would you say that that's harming the kid?
All day. I mean, especially younger, but even all of them. I mean, it's so important to see facial expressions, to be able to understand how they're being taught, to interact with their friends. There's also some data to talk about, oxygen and medical issues that may be there. It's just, and just the fear. I mean, what they're doing psychologically, we've never seen this. So we obviously have no idea what the long-term and short-term implications are. So this is just something that's unnecessary and unwise.
Last week we had on Dr. Joel Fishbane, and he is the one of the specialists on pandemics over at Beaumont. And he was talking about how this conversation about COVID really needs to be more looked at in terms of years and maybe decades as opposed to months and days, and that we could be dealing with COVID long, long into the future. Are you concerned about setting, with that in mind, are you concerned about setting a precedent with people wearing masks or kids wearing masks, in the sense that if we're doing it now, the risk next year may not be any less, and the year after that may not be any less with all the different variants flying around? And what we're doing is we're setting up a culture where that eventually could be the norm, where we're all wearing masks all the time because we're always worried about COVID.
People need to look at the science, and this is not a society that we want to live in, where we're all masked up all the time and scared of, the next invisible thing that government people start telling us about. I mean, they would love to have us nice and compliant and masked up and scared and, looking to them to save us. It's not something that we should be doing. And I think a lot of parents said, that's it. We you guys did it last year. It was unnecessary for the kids, but it was done and we're not going along with it anymore. This is not the society we want to live in.
Just to be clear, your position is that if a school board, if a local school board wants to require masks in school, you're fine with that, but you're just not excited about the state setting some kind of standard or expectation that they do so.
Well, when you say I'm fine with it, I would, if it was nearby, or if I, had the opportunity to oppose it, I would, want to go and voice my concern. If somebody wanted me to send a letter, I certainly would, because I think it's unwise, but I certainly want it to, I would allow it to be done at the local level. I don't think the state should be, not allowing it. I think that, maybe if a ton of the parents in a district want it, I don't know. I mean, I think that it is a local control decision, if that's what you're getting at.
Okay. All right. Anything else about masks or vaccines that you think is important that maybe I didn't ask about, but you really want to touch on?
I go back to that really the risk is so low. People don't talk about relative risk. I mean, I've made it clear. I've got it on my website at tomforsbe.com, where I take the CDC data, and, it's five times less likely for kids 0 to 17 to die of COVID as it is for them to die in a car crash. I mean, yes, one child is too many in death, but, there's going to be kids, unfortunately, that die of all kinds of things, and we got to put things into perspective. And that's just not being done. So I think that if people realize that it's just unnecessary, the risk is very low, even with the Delta variant and, whatever is next going to come, and that really parents know what's best for the kids. And I really do hope that districts will look and also look at other states. I mean, there's plenty of states that are not requiring it. There's plenty of countries that are not requiring the masks and they're doing fine. So I think that we need to listen to parents.
All right. Tom McMillan, a Republican member of the State Board of Education, former state representative. Thanks for taking a few minutes with us today.
All right. Thanks, Kyle.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the director, Elizabeth Hertel, for spending some time with us. Tom McMillan, State Board of Education. Josh Pugh and Andrea Bitely for coming into MERS World Headquarters. John and Jack and Samantha. You probably got thrown for a loop when you came in here, Andrea. You see all these microphones and mixing board and everything here. You thought we were going to get super professional on you here.
I was hoping, Kyle. I was hoping. These look like grade A professional microphones. I National Public Radio, look out.
Yeah. Oh, it's here. It's here. And it's all because of our friend Walt Sword from the Michigan Polycast. He sold us some of his stuff here. And as soon as I know how to use it and we get our studio, John, we are going to be rocking and rolling.
We will be. It's going to be amazing.
It's going to
sound quality. It's going to be unbelievable.
It's going to be. We're going to be almost as good as the Oatmeal Podcast from Matt Resch, Josh.
I like how we're closing as we open. We have a very visual podcast. We're talking about the room. We started talking about my haircut. This is great. We're gonna have to figure out how to get some of these visuals in for the listening audience.
Kyle, MERS Monday is going to be the perfect podcast.
Perfect podcast.
Well, we're 95% or between 95 and 99% there already, aren't we?
I guess so. I guess I hadn't put a percentage to it, though, Jack. That's not bad, though. I like your percentages. Also, thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care. She blinded me with science.